From the Center for Investigative Reporting and PRX, this is Reveal. I'm Al Letson.
Okay. Can you take me through your tattoos?
Well, I had always wanted a tattoo or two. And then the one down the back of my neck says, I'm not anti-religion. Religion is anti-me. And so that just kind of speaks for itself.
Today on the show, a woman says she was abused and shunned by her faith.
Because I had been told, don't speak of this, it's a confidential matter. The congregation doesn't need to know this.
And she was left behind by her family.
Even when I was speaking on the stand, I looked out and my mother and dad wouldn't look at me.
The power of shunning, coming up. There's always more to the story. That's usually how we end our show, but today, that's where we're starting. A story can surprise you and move you, and it usually does lead to another story. Sometimes the stories we share can spark change, but they can also show us how someone doing wrong can get away with it for years. Back in February, we took a look at the culture of secrecy within the Jehovah's Witnesses. Today, we're going to revisit that story and bring you a second chapter. Just a note here, we're going to be covering some difficult material related to sexual abuse. Our story begins with Candace Conti. She was in grade school when she went on field service calls trying to recruit people to join the Jehovah's Witnesses with a man named Jonathan Kendrick.
He was very dominating. He commanded a presence. To me, he's just big, you know?
When they were alone, Candace says, Kendrick would take her to his house and molest her. Kendrick denies his claim and was never prosecuted for it, but a jury in a civil lawsuit found wrongdoing. Candace blames the policies of the Jehovah's Witnesses for failing to protect her from abuse. And across the country, lawsuits against the organization are mounting. But the witnesses are fighting these claims in court. They argue their child abuse policies should be protected by the First Amendment. To them, it's a matter of religious freedom. Reveal reporter Trey Bundy and producer Delaney Hall tell the story.
Last year, a package arrived at the Center for Investigative Reporting. It was a plain manila envelope. Trey Bundy opened it up.
It was a stack of documents, and one of the first things we saw was confidential.
A man with ties to the Jehovah's Witnesses had sent the package. The envelope was filled with documents from the Watchtower Bible and Tract Society, the global headquarters of the Jehovah's Witnesses in New York. That's where the organization's governing body lives and works.
They are the spiritual leaders of the organization. They're the equivalent of the Pope in the Catholic Church.
That means they set policy for the organization and distribute it through memos sent to elders at congregations across the country.
Okay, here we go.
Trey started reading through the documents. The language is this mix of corporate policy and Bible verse.
So from Ecclesiastes 3:7, they say there's a time to keep quiet when your words should prove to be few.
The memos described how congregation elders should handle allegations of child sex abuse.
Improper use of the tongue by an elder can result in serious legal problems for the individual, the congregation, and even the society. And by that, they mean the Watchtower Society.
And boiled down, here's what the memos said.
Keep your mouth shut. Do not go to law enforcement.
Erwin Zalkin is a lawyer in San Diego. He has more than a dozen sex abuse lawsuits pending against the Watchtower. He's studied these memos and deposed leaders in the organization. He says the policy on sex abuse is clear.
You come to us first. Don't you tell anybody. You don't warn parents in the congregation. We'll decide what happens here. That's their policy.
Which is in line with the organization's general mistrust of the outside world.
They look at the rest of the world as being diseased, as being controlled by Satan. So essentially, they're told not to mix with the rest of the world any more than they have to.
Trey decided to learn everything he could about this closed community. And in the process, he discovered the Watchtower has worked with local congregations to hide sex abuse from law enforcement. The organization's policies are wrapped in biblical language, and those policies have allowed perpetrators to escape the law, and in some cases, to abuse multiple victims.
Chapter 5. Now the works of the flesh are manifest, and they are fornication, uncleanness, loose conduct, and things like these. That those who practice such things will not inherit God's kingdom.
Which brings us back to Candace Conti. She experienced the effects of the Watchtower's policies firsthand. She says that after Jonathan Kendrick molested her, she didn't tell anyone about it. She kept attending meetings at her North Fremont congregation. The elders there had known her pretty much all her life.
In particular, Larry Lamberton, Michael Clark, Abrahamson, they all watched me grow up. You know what I mean? It is that tight-knit of a community. I mean, there really is no outside. This is your association.
What Candace did not know was that at least two of those elders were already aware that Kendrick had a history of abuse. Just a year before, he told them that he'd sexually molested his 13-year-old stepdaughter. Here's Trey again.
When the elders in Fremont discovered that Kendrick had abused his stepdaughter, they notified the Watchtower in writing. A couple of weeks later, the Watchtower sent a letter back to North Fremont saying that what Kendrick did was considered uncleanness.
Uncleanness is a term from the Bible, and it's considered a minor offense.
Because of that, the sanctions against him wouldn't be as harsh.
Good morning. This marks the beginning of videotape number one in the deposition of Michael Clark.
Years later, in a legal deposition, a Fremont elder named Michael Clark acknowledged that, yes, they'd known that Kendrick had abused multiple victims.
Did you notify law enforcement of the information that you had received about the touching of these two girls by Mr. Kendrick?
No.
Why not?
Our legal department advised me.
At this point, Jehovah's Witness lawyer James McCabe jumps in.
I'm going to object. I'm going to ask you not to say what they advised you, but you can just say that you contacted the legal department and you acted accordingly.
I'll join in that objection.
Clark also said that the Fremont elders didn't inform the congregation about Kendrick's abuse.
We don't make that public to the congregation. That's confidential.
And that's the policy and the practice of Jehovah's Witnesses that you learned as an elder, correct?
Yes.
So parents in the congregation, including Candace's parents, weren't notified that Kendrick was a child abuser. Kendrick separated from his wife, and when he moved to a new congregation in Oakley, a town about an hour north, they weren't notified either.
Chapter 5. Therefore, to the older men among you, I give this exhortation. Shepherd the flock of God in your care, not under compulsion, but willingly. Neither for love of dishonest gain, but eagerly.
Okay, the whole letter. Dear brothers, enclosed are the publisher cards of Brother Jonathan Kendrick and our comments.
Roger Bentley served as an elder in Oakley for almost 3 decades. He loved his job. He called himself God's co-worker. A little while after Kendrick arrived, Roger and the other Oakley elders got in touch with Kendrick's old congregation. They asked the elders there to send a letter of introduction, which they did. It mentioned that Kendrick had had a rocky marriage, but for the most part, it was positive.
The skills of Brother Kendrick vary from violin playing and topiary to woodworking and welding. He is a very interesting individual who has taken the lead with some young ones in the congregation and helped them from veering off course.
The letter didn't mention child abuse. In fact, it implied that he was good with kids.
You know, looking back now what I know, this is crazy.
So Kendrick began to settle in. He met and eventually married a woman in the congregation named Linda Hood. Roger actually officiated. And then things went bad.
Mr. Kendrick, can you state your name and spell your last name for the record?
Jonathan Kendrick, K-E-N.
A few years after they got married, Kendrick sexually molested Linda's granddaughter, Beth. That's not her real name, by the way. We don't reveal the identities of child sex abuse victims if they want to remain anonymous. Kendrick admitted to it and eventually served less than a year in jail. This is from a legal deposition in 2012.
When did you sexually touch her granddaughter?
Late January or February, when she was 6.
Kendrick has never admitted to abusing Candace, but in this same deposition, he did confess to molesting his stepdaughter from his previous marriage back in Fremont. And he talked about how the elders there responded.
What did Brother Abrahamson say in this regard?
Said to not be alone with children, not allow myself to get in a position where claims could be made against me.
Chapter 10, Proverbs of Solomon. In the abundance of words, there does not fail to be transgression, but the one keeping his lips in check is acting discreetly.
The Watchtower requires strict communication with congregation elders. And attorney Irwin Zalkin says that almost two decades ago, the organization sent out a letter asking for information very relevant to this story.
They sent out a letter to every elder in the entire United States and said, we want you to give us all your information on anyone that's a known child sex abuser in your congregation.
They required congregations to answer specific questions related to the nature of the abuse, the name of the offender, and when it happened. So Zalkin figured,
there must be a database for this. They didn't just do this for the fun of it.
Zalkin subpoenaed the Watchtower to turn over that database when he was arguing another case, but they refused. They said their data on child abusers is mixed up in millions of other documents, and it would take too long to search them. When the Watchtower wouldn't hand over that information, the judge in the case struck their defense and awarded a $13.5 million default judgment to Zalkin's client. 7 years after Jonathan Kendrick molested Beth in Oakley, Candace Conti learned about the abuse.
I had this sense of guilt. You know, what if I did something? What if I hadn't been such a coward? What if I had done something to maybe protect this other child, you know?
So Candace decided to bring a civil lawsuit against Kendrick, the North Fremont congregation, and the Watchtower. In 2012, a jury found that the organization was negligent because they'd known that Kendrick was dangerous. They awarded Candace more than $15 million in damages to be paid by Kendrick, North Fremont, and the Watchtower. But the Watchtower and the North Fremont congregation appealed.
May it please the court, James McCabe on behalf of the North Fremont Congregation of Jehovah's Witnesses. I have 2 points.
We attended that appeal hearing and listened in on the Watchtower's arguments. Witness lawyers talked about the First Amendment and the constitutional right to religious freedom.
The religious beliefs and standards of Jehovah's Witnesses were at play in this case from start to finish.
Namely, in the Watchtower letters that outline sex abuse policy.
And the elders are counseled in that letter to give special heed to the counsel, do not reveal the confidential talk of another, quoting from the Bible book of Proverbs, chapter 25, verse 9.
Because those policy letters are filled with references to Scripture, lawyers argue their First Amendment right of religious freedom protects them from scrutiny. But guess who isn't buying that? Zalkin.
That's not the law. The law is that, you know, we can't question what you believe. Believe what you want to believe. But we can question your conduct.
But as the Watchtower faces a growing number of sex abuse lawsuits across the country, they're actually doubling down on their policies. Their most recent memo about how to handle crimes came out late last year. Again, it discourages elders from reporting to police, and it advises them to rely on internal judicial committees instead.
And then it lists the types of crimes they're talking about: murder, rape, child abuse, fraud, theft, and assault. They're essentially strengthening their original position. We're not going to cooperate. We're not going to talk.
The Watchtower wouldn't agree to an interview with Trey, but the organization did send a statement. It said the Jehovah's Witnesses abhor child abuse, that congregation elders comply with child abuse reporting laws, and that they're committed to doing all they can to prevent child abuse. As for the Candace Conti case, a few months ago, the California Court of Appeals found the leadership of the Jehovah's Witnesses wasn't required to warn congregants about Jonathan Kendrick. They knocked Candace's original award down from about $16 million to just under $3 million. The Watchtower appealed that ruling before settling with Candace for an undisclosed amount. For more on this story, let's bring in reporter Trey Bundy. Hi, Trey.
Hi, Al.
So what kind of reaction did you get to this story when it first aired?
The reaction was immediate. Within a few days, we'd received hundreds of messages, emails, Facebook messages, phone calls from people who were telling us that they had been abused as young Jehovah's Witnesses, and also people that they knew. It basically reinforced what we'd been learning all along, which was that this is not an isolated problem and that young Jehovah's Witnesses are abused in many congregations in many parts of the world.
If so many people in the organization have been abused, how was the Watchtower able to keep it quiet for so long?
The witnesses are an insular group. They're taught not to associate with the rest of the world any more than they have to. So one of the ways the organization enforces its will is through shunning or the threat of shunning. So for instance, in an abuse case, if somebody speaks up or calls the police when they've been instructed not to, that can be a disfellowshipping offense. And that's something that we came across in California, in Oklahoma, and other parts of the country. Once they're disfellowshipped, everybody else in the congregation is instructed to shun them, and that includes their friends, their family. If they work for Jehovah's Witness, it can include their employer. The stakes are really high.
Trey has been looking at the practice of shunning, how it can be used to keep people from coming forward to report abuse. Trey went to McAlester, Oklahoma, to meet 46-year-old Debbie McDaniel. She says a Jehovah's Witness elder abused her from the age of 8 to 13. And when she was older, he kicked her out of the congregation. Debbie has tattoos on her arms, back, and neck that she says tell the story of her life.
And then the one down the back of my neck says, I'm not anti-religion. Religion is anti-me. And so that just kind of speaks for itself.
Trey Bundy picks up the story there.
So Debbie was born in Houston and lived there until she was about 5 years old. Her dad, a man named Wendell Marley, worked for NASA and was, by all accounts, a brilliant engineer. He helped design and build the spacecraft that put Neil Armstrong on the moon. But then one day, he gave it all up.
When he met Jehovah's Witnesses and thought he had found the true religion and the world was ending any time, he just walked away from his career.
Wendell moved Debbie and the rest of the family to McAlester, Oklahoma, where he quickly rose through the ranks of the local Kingdom Hall. That's the place of worship for witnesses. Wendell became the number two guy, and the number one guy was an elder named Ronnie Lawrence.
I was introduced to Ronnie as somebody quite Christ-like. People revered him.
But Debbie told me that when she was 8 years old, Ronnie started abusing her. The abuse went on for 5 years. She didn't tell anyone about it, but she did get angry. She told me she became rebellious as a teenager and started drinking and having sex. And when Ronnie found out about it, he decided to disfellowship her for sexual immorality. At that point, Debbie told her mom for the first time that Ronnie had abused her.
I said, well, I find it funny that the man who messed with me my whole life, my whole childhood, is now in a position to disfellowship me from the organization. And my mom was furious, livid. She said, you're going to lie about this man of God now? She said, you're just trying to get him back for disfellowshipping you for your wrongdoing. And I thought, you know, they're never going to believe me.
Being thrown out of the congregation was terrifying for Debbie, like it is for many witnesses. She was completely isolated from her friends and family. She thought her eternal soul was on the line.
Just trying to adjust to life outside the organization was too much for me, and I just wanted back in.
To get back in, she had to write a letter of apology to the elders, including Ronnie. By this time, Debbie had figured out that she was a lesbian, but she just pushed those feelings aside. She married a witness and had a kid. She threw everything she had into the organization.
Door to door, study for the meetings, make every meeting. I was going to be the best Jehovah's Witness I could be.
A decade passes, and other people in Debbie's congregation have started to come forward, saying Ronnie abused them too. I've looked at letters from elders to the Watchtower, and they show that Ronnie was disfellowshipped, but he repented and was welcomed back on the condition that he name all of his victims and write them letters of apology.
So he says, Debbie, I humbly want to apologize for the hurt and pain I have caused you and for denying it. I have truly sinned against you, Jehovah, and the congregation. I betrayed the trust.
It was hard for Debbie to be around him, and she worried about other kids in the congregation. She says the elders told her to drop it and keep quiet.
Because I had been told through the whole proceedings with Ronnie, don't speak of this, it's a confidential matter. The congregation doesn't need to know this, and if you talk about it, that's grounds for disfellowshipping.
Eventually, Debbie couldn't take it anymore. She left her marriage and was disfellowshipped again, this time for coming out as gay. And that's when the shunning got really bad. Her daughter Marley was 12 years old and got caught in a nasty custody battle between her parents. Marley says her dad and Debbie's family coached her on what to say in text messages to her mom.
Yeah, they used to sit me down and actually tell me what to say or text me something and say just to copy and paste it and send it to her.
This text message came from Marley, and she said, you want to know why I'm devastated? I lost my mother, my best friend. You turned to Satan and you're going to die.
I thought that there would come a point when God would judge us all, and then and Mom would be basically destroyed. That's what I've heard my whole life.
The shunning and harassment got so intense that Debbie finally went to the police about it. Her whole story came pouring out. The police had never been informed about Ronnie's abuse of children. They started an investigation, and there was a hearing. And at that hearing, Debbie says, the shunning continued. She remembers going into the courtroom, and her parents were sitting behind Ronnie on his side.
They wouldn't look my direction. Even when I was speaking on the stand, I looked out, and my mother and dad wouldn't look at me in the face.
The charges against Ronnie Lawrence were dismissed because of the statute of limitations. But court records and letters from McAllister elders to the Watchtower back up Debbie's story. Ronnie is still a Jehovah's Witness, and Debbie still runs into him around town.
Hello, Mr. Lawrence?
Yes, sir.
Hi, my name's Trey Bundy.
I went to his house to see him.
There are a lot of people in this town that believe that you did commit these crimes.
Well, what do you want me to say?
I want you to tell me whether you committed these crimes.
No, I didn't, but that's all right. You're not going to blame me, neither will anyone else, so...
Well, there's a lot of documentation. Why did you write letters of apology if you weren't going to, you know, if you didn't commit these crimes?
It had to do with several things, but I...
Was a part of it getting back into the organization? Was that part of the condition of coming back to the organization? Okay. Thank you.
Debbie has built a new life, but she keeps a permanent record of the past.
My daughter, Marley, was so attached to the organization, and so I did a tattoo of her with holding a maze behind her, and it felt like she was trying to come out of the organization, but the maze was the organization, and she was hanging on to it, so I added that.
But Marley has come out of the organization. She and Debbie have reunited, and they live together now. But since they've become close again, the witnesses have started to shun Marley, too.
Well, obviously, all my friends were... a couple years ago were all Jehovah's Witnesses, and so I've lost pretty much all of them, and then the rest of my family has pretty much blocked me on social media, things like that. You can't leave and not be deemed mentally diseased, I guess. So something has to be wrong with you. I have to make up something.
That story was reported by Reveal's Trey Bundy and produced by Delaney Hall. To read more about Debbie's experience with images and additional sound from Oklahoma, visit revealnews.org. It's really worth checking out. Check back with us next Tuesday for another podcast. We'll be telling the story of a master con man that's almost too crazy to be true. Do not miss it. If you have a minute, let us know what you think of the show. Search Reveal on iTunes. Leave us a review. It makes a huge difference and helps new listeners find us. You can also tweet us at Reveal or share your thoughts on our Facebook page. And remember, we're also on air. Check your local public radio station to see what time they're airing us. And if they aren't, well, they should be. This episode was edited by Patricia Flynn. Thanks to editor Fernando Diaz for his work on the story. Our lead sound designer and engineer is my man, Mr. Jay Breezy, Jim Briggs. Our editorial director is Robert Salad. Today, our managing director is Krista Scharfenberg. Suzanne Reber is our executive editor, and our executive producer is Kevin Sullivan. Our theme music today is from Camarado Lightning. Support for Reveal is provided by the Reva and David Logan Foundation, the Ford Foundation, and the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation. Reveal is a co-production of the Center for Investigative Reporting and PRX. I'm Al Letson, and remember, there is always more to the story.